Hello, I'm Cliff Huddis from Medscape. I'm pleased to welcome a special guest today, Siddhartha Mukherjee, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Emperor of All Maladies, and co-producer of Ken Burns' six-hour documentary of that book, which will air at the end of March. Sid, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sid, you started writing The Emperor in 2004, and it's been more than 10 years since then. With the adaptation of the book coming out now as a six-hour documentary. How does this make you feel? I mean, did you imagine that that book would lead to this project?
Absolutely not. I mean, everything in the project has been a surprise, including, you know, the developments of science and medicine while we were making the film. They were all surprises. So, I mean, obviously when you start a project like this, you had never imagined where direction it could go, and it's just, you know, it goes in so many different ways. But I'm so delighted that this came about.
What would you say was your actual primary goal? I mean, all of us in science write papers. You sat down with a blank piece of paper and a pen. I've even heard stories about you doing this at the end of the workday from some of our mutual colleagues. What were you aiming for in the beginning?
Well, in the beginning, the book was, you know, a very different kind of book. I was keeping a journal. So I was going to the hospital, and I was a fellow, as you've been, as all of us have been, you know, nose to the ground, doing the usual things that you would do every day, writing orders for chemotherapy and trying to figure out how to best help our patients. And then in the middle of all of this, I was just struck by a small comment. You know, I think every book or every creative project really begins at one moment when you clearly remember that moment. And for me, that moment was a woman came up. I was treating her. She was actually on a third round of a kinase inhibitor trial, and she for a abdominal sarcoma. And she said to me, you know, I can go on, but I need to know what it is that I'm fighting. She had a southern accent that I won't imitate. But and it struck me that I was a fellow, as I said. It struck me then that I had no real tools to answer that question. I mean, where were we now? Had we gotten here that she was being treated on a third generation kinase inhibitor? What was happening next? What was the landscape look like? So that's how the book started.
You know, that story is, I think, emblematic of so much of the messaging we always want to get out. And one of the things that science has been relatively bad at. We don't often tell our stories to the lay public, to the general public, all that well, all that clearly. And both the documentary and the book are really powerful examples of storytelling. How important is the storytelling aspect of all of this to you? In other words, could this have existed if it wasn't for the personal stories that are woven through the book and the documentary?
It couldn't. I mean, the entire thrust of the documentary and the book is that all of this should and can be achieved by storytelling. I mean, you know, I also would make the argument that there is no science outside storytelling, and those are fundamentally linked problems. If you ask the greatest clinicians, the greatest scientists about their most innovative work, they describe that work not in some kind of abstract equation, but they can describe that work in terms of storytelling. They tell you exactly what made them think of something, what its history was, what the past was, how they arrived at the idea, and how they then incorporated it into their own stories. So I think you can't imagine medicine outside storytelling. At least I can't imagine. And that's how I structured the book, and that's how the documentary is sort of story upon story and upon story, and it builds from there.
And so turning to the documentary, how did that project, as an outgrowth of the book, actually get started? And as co-producer, I mean, this is a role that most of the clinical audience really has no insight into. I mean, what did you do as a co-producer? So that's sort of two questions. How did you get started, and then what was the function?
So the first piece, how the documentary got started, is an interesting story. Before my book was formally published, you know, it was a sheaf of papers, big sheaf of papers, and it landed up on the desk, and I actually still don't know how, it landed up on the desk of Laura Ziskin, who was running Stand Up to Cancer. Unfortunately, she died. I'll come to that in a second. She was an amazing producer herself, had a great vision, but also was undergoing treatment for metastatic breast cancer at that time. And then as the head of Stanford Cancer, she called me up, cold call on the phone. I was sitting in my office in New York, cold call on the phone, said, "I'm Laura Ziskin," and I knew who she was. And she said, "I'm at the Crosby Hotel. Would you come within 2 or 3 hours? I'm here for just one day because I want to discuss turning your book," which is not even a book then, it was a sheaf of papers, into a documentary. So I said, "Sure, I'll come." So I took the train down and I, you know, opened
this is a reminder that we still take the subway.
That's right. It's actually a reminder that we still answer our own phones.
That's true.
Which is important. And Laura said, "You know, we have to convert this into a documentary. I know how to do that." And I said, "That's absolutely wonderful. That's incredible." So I went back and I was still thinking about Laura's offer and we were sort of putting it into place, excited, and so forth. And then this is a real story, truth being stranger than fiction. 2 weeks or 3 weeks later, I get a phone call, again, cold phone call in my office from Ken Burns saying, "We want to do this as a documentary." And so I said, these two things have got to come together. And so Laura and Ken collaborated in putting together, actually the PBS team collaborated in putting together the documentary. And it was one of the amazing, you know, public-private collaborations, Stand Up to Cancer, PBS, WIDA. Sharon Rockefeller was the kind of person behind the WIDA aspect. And that's how the whole thing came together. Now, I should say that technically I'm not a co-producer of the film because it's a PBS documentary, but my role has been to be sort of the advisor to the script to make sure that the story was told in the way that's true to the book, but also is true to the history. And that's how sort of that's been my role. And I stayed with the documentary from day zero till the very last edit of the very last cut. I must have seen it with Ken and with Barak 26 times, fine-tuning every single aspect, making sure that, you know, the stories were balanced, they were appropriate, but they also retained that sort of urgency of storytelling, which is so crucial to any project in medicine.
So one of the things you just said caught me a little bit by surprise. I want to make sure I heard this right. Were you actually the connector between Ken Burns and Laura Ziskin, or...?
I was the connector between Ken
That's
Burns
really
and
a remarkable yes. Fact, which probably wouldn't be clear to people. 10 years is a bit of a long time, and in fact, the last 10 years have been very exciting in science. How have you molded or reshaped the story from what you wrote to what is actually true and relevant today? There are areas of scientific work and translational science and clinical results that I think were only dreams 10 years ago.
And that's absolutely right. And that was one of the most interesting things about the project. It was also an opportunity to update the book. I mean, so, you know, in the book, the one thing that I wanted to make sure, of course, like any other work about science, the science will overtake the book at some point in time, but the content will overtake the book, but the form remains the same. The mistakes that we make, the way we acquire information, the innovations, the cycle of innovation remains the same. So that lives on in the book in some ways, the form of the way we discover things. Now, in terms of content, of course, things change. Mm-hmm. And one of the most exciting things, I think, while making the documentary was new fields came alive. The whole field of immunotherapy, I mean, had been alive. People had been looking at using the immune system to attack and kill cancer. But it was sort of a dream in someone's eye. It came clinically alive while the documentary was being made. So we had to actually change the script because at one point in time when we first wrote the script, you know, it was there, but it was sort of a tail end of the script. And it was about, you know, how hopeful would it be? What a nice fantasy it would be if you could somehow train your immune system to now recognize and kill cancer cells. And while the film was being made, that fantasy began to come real. Not in every case, and there were some ifs, ands, or buts with that kind of therapy, but we saw it come alive. So the script had to be changed to reflect that. And now that became, from a 4-minute segment, that became a 20-minute segment that really sort of bookends the film.
So that's interesting. So in a sense, the documentary can't be, at this point, a pure retelling of the concrete stories in the book. It has to have evolved to incorporate new science.
And it had to. I mean, you know, and that was the plan up front. So when the first decision was made with Ken and Laura and me and Barak was brought in, we had decided we would not copy the book. So we said that, you know, we would keep stories that were current, that were based in the present, in the film, and the film would go back and forth between those contemporary stories and history. so that you would understand what the links were between, you know, work being done in the 1950s and the treatment of a woman with breast cancer in 2015. You know, those two things would come alive in a way that if you just stole the story sort of sequentially or narratively, you wouldn't. So the film, we made a very upfront decision, would be intercalated this way. Mm-hmm. You would go back and forth in history and contemporary stories. And the second thing that I think is very interesting about just the filmmaking, and going back to your question about storytelling, was that the camera teams, based on an agreement with Hopkins and with a community hospital in the South, the camera teams were embedded in the hospital so that patients, given their permission, would allow us to film them on day zero of their diagnosis. And you would follow them longitudinally forward. So it wasn't retrospectively following them. It was following them as their stories unfolded. And that was an incredibly powerful way of thinking about this. You felt the urgency interposed against the kind of the deep history.
I'm curious to see, and I'm sure many people will be, that focus that you just described is compelling. But there's a risk in that, of course, mm-hmm. for everybody involved. And even those patients who are fortunate enough to benefit from really impressive, what we call impressive breakthroughs. In some diseases, they have been transformed, and what used to be a near-death sentence can be a chronic illness. That's true. But as we know, in others, we get remarkable responses that have been unprecedented, and we get benefit, but we still, unfortunately, can have a sad mm-hmm. ending. How did you cope with that in terms of the context of a public storytelling and not... let's say, raising hope too far, but also not dashing it too much? How do you manage
So I think,
that?
I mean, the mood of the, I think the mood in the documentary has to be faithful to what's happening in medicine. Mm-hmm. And there was a kind of, there was some sobriety about it and remains, and the optimism had to be balanced against what was sobering. And the point was not to flinch from what's been tough. Mm. You know, you witness, not on camera, but you know when patients die on film. You know, we didn't want to invade privacy. But on the other hand, you didn't want to, you know, sugarcoat a story, which is very, very complicated, with enormous strides for some patients, transformative medical therapies for some patients, and yet no successes for others. We didn't want to do that. So you will watch on camera really tough moments when patients face their deaths, and when medicine faces its failures. I mean, it's got to be shown. If you don't show it, you all of a sudden, you know, you create a sugar-coated version of reality, and that was not the purpose.
Well, I think that can be very helpful, because one of the issues that we've been talking about in the past, and I actually focused a good bit on this last year at ASCO, is the partnership between society, that is, uh-huh. society at large, and the scientific community, which is really focused on solving these problems, let's not be unclear, for society. I mean, there is not a difference between science and society. We are part of society. So by telling these stories, one hopes that we will engage all of the public in providing more of the kind of support that I think we need to accelerate the already impressive advances that we've been seeing. Given your vantage point, I mean, how do you see us doing that? What would you advise our community of scientists and physicians and translational investigators to do? This is one important step. How do we leverage this to do more and to do it faster, do you think?
I mean, I think the most important idea, I think, in this is a kind of truth-telling. You know, when medicine gets oppositional with its own... conclusions when it tries to hide what's known and what's not known, I think it just gets into deeper and deeper trouble. There is a, you know, the openness of being able to tell people, look, you know, these have been transformative advances, but there's still a lot to do. Mm-hmm. And you know, our biggest asset is hope, but it's also our biggest vulnerability, right? Because we so badly want this to happen well. We so badly want to find a cure that the hope gets in the way. We try to describe to people and want them to be hopeful, but of course, you know, there's a balance between providing the right kind of hope and blowing it out of context. And I think that's very hard to reach. As long as you're honest with that, I think that's very helpful.
I think you touch on something that is really profound and hard to convey, and I think the film will resonate for many of the professionals who get to watch it, and I suspect, of course, for patients as well. But that fine line between honest hopefulness and truth-telling, which doesn't destroy hope, is tricky because, of course, it varies for each patient and each family and their needs. And I just think that this should help contribute to that openness.
That's what the art of medicine is. Yeah. I mean, great clinicians know how to do this and actually describe this passage in the book, watching, you know, someone like Tom Lynch do it, you know, never destroying it, never asphyxiating the hope itself, but never creating a false impression of what's available and what can happen. So, I mean, it's the art of medicine.
Yeah, the nuance, which we all live through, is if you're really a sensitive clinician, then you never think you quite got it right.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's really true. So talking about that, one of the wrinkles is that this time in our scientific development is very focused on technology, high technology, new views of medicine, new views of the drug therapy that we're developing. And the costs are something that are increasingly being focused on and transparently and openly. As you bring to light the really remarkable advances of the last few years, how do you think about one of what I think is our intentions, which is access to care and availability?
You know, the issues of access are complicated. On one hand, there's the issue of access to even the basic level of healthcare. Now, with oncology, you're talking about much more complicated healthcare and often much more expensive medicines. If you know, particularly if you're talking about the newer medicines that are being invented. So again, it's the question is finding a balance. Actually, we cover access in the documentary. Mm. There's a section that was dedicated to access to inform people how complicated it's gotten for patients to be able to access the medicines that they need, especially the newer targeted therapies or immunological therapies in terms of the cost. So I would encourage you and others, I mean, you'll see it coming alive in the documentary.
Yeah, I think this is going to turn out to be a really important issue because, again, it has to do with who's paying and for what. Mm-hmm. We all benefit from everyone getting highest quality of care, in fact. I'm reminded of that. It's a side issue, but the fact that copays actually diminish people's compliance with really transformative drugs like imatinib, mm-hmm. Which the clinical audience here will know about. And I called this out, but it makes no sense to have a financial disincentive to compliance.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense for society. So I wonder if you've had some thoughts about that. How much are we able to engage in some discussion about, let's say, continued reform in terms of insurance coverage?
I'm not the expert on insurance coverage, but the thought that I've had several times is that on the end of someone who is a physician scientist, a translational scientist, you know, our end of the job is to improve technologies to the point of time where the wastage is limited. In other words, if you're giving medicine to someone who won't receive it or benefit from that medicine because of their genetic makeup, then that can vastly improve the quality of access. You know, access isn't just money. It's giving the right medicine to the right person at the right time for the right disease, right?
So, well, that's precision medicine.
That's precision medicine. So, so from the standpoint of science and innovation, the cycle of innovation, I think we can also contribute to access enormously by you know, we can't solve the right price problem, but we can solve the right person problem and the right medicine problem. And I think pharmaceutical companies can and will and should solve the same problem, which is that, you know, inventing yet another ineffective drug which increases lifespan by 2.5 weeks is not going to, and pricing it at some gigantic number is not going to solve the problem. On the other hand, if you really find the right target patient with the right medicine can increase their meaningful life by 5 years, you know, then the whole access discussion becomes very different.
Yeah. So that, I think that's, again, a very profound way to look at it, and I agree with you. One of the things that is frequently a concern is that somehow worrying about this will diminish the enthusiasm and investment in innovation, and that's an important point.
This is absolutely
point.
Incorrect.
We can't let that happen.
Well, it's absolutely incorrect. You know, people say, I mean, for again, now speaking to the to the people who would think about translational medicine, innovation cycles, you know, access should make us, the issue of access should make us even more excited.
Yeah.
Because this is a problem that can be, as I said, it can be solved by figuring out the money part of the equation. But on our end, we have to figure out the right person part of the equation, the right science. I think it's exciting. It's innovation. I mean, you know, you have to innovate yourself out of the access problem. And I don't think we're doing that appropriately right now.
I think that's a very good way to look at it, though. I agree with you. Now, thinking about resources, which is what we're talking about, as you know, and many in the audience will know, the last 10 years have not been so great for federally supported research. We've made remarkable advances. There are other resources that have been brought to bear. But as we know, a rough estimate is that we've lost about 25% mm-hmm. of the purchasing power at the NIH. And that's also true within the NCI component of the NIH budget. About a week or two ago, President Obama called for a new spending of about $215 million in precision medicine, the topic we've been covering. And this will get split into different domains. It covers not just oncology, but actually other areas of medicine. A challenging question that many lay people will ask is, okay, you know, Dr. Mukherjee, here's a blank check. How big does it have to be? What proportion should go where? How do you think about that problem?
Well, I mean, you know, there are greater minds at work at this problem. But just to give you a sense of what these numbers look like, $250 million is a very small amount of money. You think, you know, I call it the three zeros problem. After $1 million, for most people in the public, an extra three zeros and an extra six zeros makes no difference. But we have to discriminate between these two, you know. So the Medicare budget, for instance, is in the several trillion dollars. So that's another six zeros after a million. So, you know, you're not talking about a much smaller amount of money. Just to give you another sense of what the numbers might be, you know, the budget of the NCI and the NIH is on the order of $5-10 billion, right? So you're not adding an enormous amount to this pot of money for a very important initiative, which is precision medicine. So now that that's said and done, cancer has led the role in precision medicine because it is the most genomically annotated disease. We know more about the link between the genetic makeup of cancer and its capacity to respond to certain therapies. So obviously cancer is going to take up a chunk of that, and it's a huge clinical problem. So I'm glad that that initiative has started. I think it's underfunded. I think $215 million sounds like a lot of money, but for the scope of the problem, which will affect, as you know, one in three men and women in the country, you know, it seems like, to me, it seems enormously underfunded. But you know, I'll let smarter minds decide how much to take.
Well, you know, you're preaching to the choir, of course. I mean, one way to think about that three zeros problem, which I think you called it, is that the federal budget is around $4 trillion a year, and the NCI budget is around $5 billion a year. And to a first approximation, that makes it 0.1% of spending on a problem that, as you rightly point out, affects a third to a half of all Americans.
Yeah, it's highly disproportionate.
Yeah. I don't know what the right number is, but it doesn't feel like our spending on the problem is commensurate
Absolutely
to the challenge
not. No,
we
no,
face.
Yeah.
And one of the subtleties that we're going to confront in the coming months is whether that money is new money, even as modest as it is, or whether it's a carve-out from existing medical science programs, because in the latter case, we're robbing Peter to pay Paul. And that, to me, would be a frustration, even though it's a noble intent. You mentioned, and you're right, of course, that the reason cancer has been leading so much of this precision medicine initiative is the ability to study the genome and to relate changes in the genome of the tumor against the inherited genome and, in turn, against the natural history of the disease. And, in fact, this is a natural segue to your next book, which I understand is out later this year, which has a more narrow focus on the human gene. Can you give us a preview of what it is that you talk about there?
I'm trying to write a history of the gene as a 20th century idea. I was intrigued by the idea that that something that, you know, was discovered by accident by a myopic monk in, you know, in Europe in the 1860s by the 1960s becomes a...
You're referring to Mendel.
I'm referring to Mendel,
that's,
yeah.
Let's be clear here.
But by the 1960s, 100 years later, it becomes the centerpiece of discussion around health, disease, identity, choice, personality, temperament, illness, you know, issues that are very much at the core of human beings. And then from the 1960s onwards, becomes a locus or a place that is potentially changeable. And the power that gives, the way it changes the basis of conversation. So that very large history is juxtaposed on, and I won't tell you all the details, on a very personal history. And the book goes back and forth between that very large voice of history and the very small voice of a very personal history.
So one of the things that has always impressed me has been the depth of insight that early investigators were able to reach without any of the modern tools, from X-ray crystallography now to PCR and so forth. And yet, long before the double helix was actually described, its nature was inferred. The structure and function of genes was described actually decades before anybody could see them. Do you touch on that? And
absolutely. I mean, you know, what's interesting is, you know, Mendel didn't even have the word gene. The word gene was coined in 1900s, early 1900s. So Mendel just saw a statistical shadow. And I think, again, with this book, as with Emperor, the question that I'm very interested in is, you know, what things are we now seeing as shadows which will now become relevant or apparent 10 years or 50 years from now? What are these shadows today? And I mean, you know, they're interesting ideas. The future of fate of human gene therapy for medical diseases is, we're beginning to see sort of kind of a glimmer of shadows, as it were, after enormous failings. So those ideas are very much in the book. I mean, you know, what is seen before it can be seen? How do we see things before even technology can anticipate them?
Well, you know, one of the things I got out of our conversation just now, which I didn't get out of the book, maybe because I just didn't see it, is the constant nature of human behavior and the way we learn, as opposed to the specifics. Because what you're really describing over the decades is that the tools change, the pace of advance accelerates, and at other times maybe doesn't, but the way we process new information and incorporate it, the way we learn from what we see, does seem to be pretty much
and
the
that's
same.
That is literally the center of the book.
Yeah.
That is the center of this book, and that is the center of the last book. It's not what we learn, it's the way we learn.
Yeah.
And that's going to be constant. I argue, and will continue to argue, that's going to be constant for the foreseeable future of human beings. Not what we learn, but the way we learn.
Well, our genes make us that way,
right?
Well, I have to say, I'm sure that your new book is going to be as enthralling as the other one.
So
now that you've seen what can happen, do you imagine a documentary about the new book also?
Well, the book will have to be finished before we have to, you know, we have to come take a step back. I mean, right, you know, when you're so close to a project, you can't even see beyond it.
Yeah,
I hope so.
Listen, Sid, congratulations
so
on
much,
this,
yeah.
And thank you very much for spending this time talking to me and to our audience
my
today.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot.
It's really been enjoyable and enlightening, I hope, for everybody, but certainly for me.